Welcome everybody, ברוכים הבאים. I'm totally delighted to be in Amsterdam and to be in a community and to be in a sanctuary. So it's really the place to say, הנה מה טוב ומה נעים, שבת אחים ואחיות גם יחד. You know, how wonderful and pleasant it is for brothers and sisters to sit together. I'm very thankful for David for inviting me and to really have the pleasure of studying Torah and studying Jewish mysticism with the rabbis and rabbinic students of Holland. And it's been a wonderful morning and I'm brimming full of it. And I hope we just continue studying till the end of this week. I thought that what I wanted to bring to the more general public here when we meet is to speak about a few notions having to do with preparation for the coming 2 months. And I'm not speaking here theoretically. I'm not speaking like what does the tradition say about preparation, but I'm speaking also of myself and hopefully all of us human beings here. But, you know, soon we are entering the month of Elul, and then the month of Tishrei, and these are really the 2 months that have to do with an awakening of renewed consciousness, like waking up, okay, waking up. And I'm talking about waking up that's relevant when you're 17, and when you're 35, and when you're 78, and when you're 82. This is the time that there's a tapping on the door saying, are you awake? You know, wake up. And I thought that it's fascinating that in the Selichot, in the traditional liturgy, and the devotional poems that are said during Elul, in the Sephardic community for sure, when you wake up people at midnight, to wake up and come and study and sing and learn throughout the last part of the night, which is the tradition of Sichot, the main poem, right, the main poem that runs, you know, throughout the month and into the month of Tishrei, is a poem that says, Ben Adam, ma lecha nirdam, kum kra le'elohim. Okay? Human being, what are you doing fast asleep? Wake up. Wake up. So, first of all, it's beautiful because it's literally wake up, right? Like, wake up, get out of your pajamas, and come over to sit with the people that want to be awake. But actually, that is the call. The call is, are we awake? And the beautiful thing about this devotional poem, you can see it on your pages, right? On your pages, on the front. Man, why asleep? Like, what are you doing asleep? Wake up and call to God in supplication. Wake up and call in tachanuni. Yeah, not formal. This is not the time. Like, formal wake up. It's the time for personal, emotional wake up. So it says, pour out your conversation. Shfok limcha. Derosh shikha. Seek forgiveness from the Lord of Lords. Now, it's an anonymous poem. We don't know who wrote this devotional poem, but it is the centerpiece of the Selichot. And what I thought was fascinating is, like, where does this come from? Ben Adam, ma lecha nirdam. It comes from the book of Jonah. And the book of Jonah is the book that we read in Yom Kippur. If we make it to Mincha, we get the wonderful opportunity to read Jonah again. As our life is changing, we meet Jonah again and again. And in the book of Jonah, in the first chapter, and now I'm speaking of Jonah, but I think I'm speaking, and this is, I think, what the people that created these poems thought, that Jonah is every man and woman. Jonah is us, okay? And the first chapter of Jonah tells us the story that Jonah is given a mission. he has to get up, go out, and do his mission. And what does he do? He runs away, he's alienated from his mission, and he goes, he gets on a ship, and he wants to go as far away as he can from the mission, okay, from his life's mission. He will do anything not to be present to that responsibility. So what does he do? In his very kind of, it seems like very suicidal even mode, he goes into the ship, then he goes down in the ship, then he goes down to the bowels of the ship, the lowest place in the ship, and he immediately falls asleep. Okay, very interesting to think of that, like in the human condition. He falls into deep sleep. Now outside, the great storm starts raging, right? The great storm starts raging. All the people on the ship, they come out and they pray and they throw vessels out and they try to think how can they get the ship to maneuver to get it back to land. And Jonah is fast asleep. And then, the person who I think is one of the heroes of the book of Jonah, even though very little attention is paid to him, is the skipper, is the captain of the ship. And the captain of the ship comes down and he finds Jonah fast asleep and he says, "Hey, Ben Adam, Malecha Nivdam, hey man, what are you doing asleep? Get up, this is not a time to sleep. This is a time to wake up. Get up and cry and call and see what you can do about this time." And it's a wonder, I mean, there's been hundreds of commentaries on Jonah. And I think if Jonathan Magnus has come here, he loves doing that.
He would say, the captain says, "Kum lech."
Yeah.
Which is exactly what God says to him when he says, "Go to Nineveh."
Yeah.
So the captain echoes God's command to Jonah, which made him run away the wrong way. I mean, he's the typical prophet who does everything the prophet is not supposed to do. And all the people on the ship.
That's why he's ages ago.
Yeah, they pray, and the prophet sleeps. You know?
Yeah, the prophet sleeps, or the prophet sleeps. And I always imagine, if we look at it also in a personal or a spiritual reading, the captain is the highest voice of consciousness inside of us that is aware of what's going on in our ship, right? In our ship, some parts are awake and some parts are totally asleep. And there is the voice that comes and wakes up the Jonah. Jonah needs to be awake. Jonah shouldn't be asleep. Jonah is the name of the bird, of the soul, right? The dove. It is a symbol of the soul, and the soul is fast asleep. So anyway, that's the beginning thing that I think, isn't it wonderful that what they're aware of, and I'm not talking at all now about the ideas of the Chagim from the point of view of, I've been sinning, I'm a terrible person, I'm doing everything wrong according to the law. At least in my religious life, that is not my main agenda. It's just, and I'm looking into other levels and other strata and other generations of Jewish thinkers to see what are the ideas that they have infused into these holidays. Okay, that's where I'm coming from. Because I need to prepare myself. I don't want, like Leah Goldberg, the wonderful poetess, you know, of Israel, where she says, "Leval yehi yomi alai ergel." I don't want next year to be exactly like this year. I don't want tomorrow to be like today. And then you look and you think, so what are the prerequisites? So one of the things that I find interesting is that when the poem says, "Ben Adam, Malecha Nirdam, Kum, get up. Wake up, be present," that it echoes in a very wonderful way the basic notion of all of the Zohar, which is the main book of Jewish mysticism, okay? It is the centerpiece, the jewel in the crown, the piece of great religious artwork of Jewish mysticism is the Zohar, which is seen to be a diasporic creation written in Spain sometime during the last decades of the 13th century. And the whole of the Zohar, if you had to condense it in a soundbite, which I don't like doing, But if you have condensed it, what is it about? It's the call to wake up. Okay? It repeats in hundreds of ways, saying, wake up, wake up. And in it, there is the notion that what we see as a state of awakeness, like what we imagine ourselves now, right? 10 to 4, I think I'm awake, I'm sitting here, it's Amsterdam. What we perceive as awakeness, the mystics of the Zohar see as drowsiness, as sleep. Yeah, and their statement is that we spend most of our time asleep. And what does it mean that we're asleep? We're asleep to what we could be, okay? Because it sounds quite chutzpah, like audacious to say we are asleep, you know. I think I'm awake. Why are you saying to me that I'm asleep? But their statement is that if we're asleep to what we could be if we were awake. So I thought it would be wonderful to, first of all, just ask you, you know, just get a few ideas. If the Zohar is saying this, we don't have to bow down, you know, and say, oh, the Zohar says this. So I'm not talking about that level. But if we take upon ourselves this notion that we are asleep most of the time, and that there is no Gnostic conspiracy or bad guy making us asleep, you know, putting us asleep, then why do you think we are? How would you imagine that? What is your intuition? Why do you think we are not waking up? There's no one drugging us. The Zohar says no one's drugging us. We just choose to live like this, like sleepwalkers most of the time. What is just raised up, like association? Why not wake up? Yes. Fear. Fear of what? Yeah? Beautiful? More? Fear? What? Yeah, I already know what it's like to be like this. If I can conserve my energy by staying, yeah? Oh, yes.
Consensus reality and the fear of being unconventional.
Absolutely. I want to be like everybody else, and if everybody's asleep, yeah? More? Think of it. It's about us. It's not about anybody else. Comfort. Yeah, don't get me out of my comfort zone.
Taking everything for granted.
Yeah, beautiful.
Take care of yourself. You cannot be awake all the time. You will go totally crazy.
Right. So, like, if we would be awake, we might go psychotic, and it might be overwhelming, and God knows what will happen to me. So, I first of all have to maneuver between the different states. Beautiful. Anything more? Yeah, you never know. If I'm going to be awake, maybe there's going to be a lot of work to do. And I'm going to be responsible, and it's too much. Any other thing? Just think well about yourself. It's a good time to do it. Yes? Yes, and wait, what you're saying also has to do with the question of how, maybe I'm not waking up because I don't know that I'm asleep. I can only wake up if somebody makes me notice that there's a difference between, but if I think that this is a normative thing, then I also think that what you were saying is very important in their notion, which is, If the society or the civilization around you or the culture does not support an idea that there are other ways that we could be present in this world, then why would I do it? It would be so counterculture. It would be so subversive, and I'm not going to be supported for it. So why don't I just continue, you know, consuming, doing what everybody's doing? Why not? Does anybody else want to add anything about? Yes? Left. Yep. Yeah, it might be hard work to see. So there's no question that the Zohar goes in two directions. It's saying, could you imagine what it would be like to be awake? It would be amazing. And the reason that they're saying that they can call us to be awake is that they go back to the early Midrashim that speak about the first Adam. Yeah, that the first man and woman, when they were created, it says in Midrash Rabbah that they could see from the end of time to the end of time. And also it means from the one end of the world to the other end of the world. But so they say, this is the potential. We are divinely created. And as divinely created people, are we trying to be awake? Now, Maimonides, who was the philosopher that wrote more than 100 years before the Zohar, he was a little more brutal about it. And he said, well, why asleep? Because people, most of them choose to spend their life sleeping, having sex, and eating. That's really what they're interested in. And my mother just said, and that's why I don't want to speak with most of these people, because I don't find it to be relevant, because they're not interested in what I'm trying to do as a philosopher. The Zohar doesn't speak in that form, because it's much more human-oriented, and it's much more education, so it's like calling you, it says, come, wake up, I have something to show you. You know, there's something to be seen when we wake up. So that's the direction that they go in. And they speak about the fact that it is true. There's a lot of work to do when our consciousness is awakened. Okay? So what I want to do in like the next 10 minutes, I think that's kind of the time that we have, but will be good for it, is to look at what is their notion of awakening. Okay? Awakening in the sense having to do with the month of Elul and Tishrei has to do with an awakening to our intimacy with ourselves and to our intimacy with God. Now that's a strange thing to say. That's the language that they use. That's their language that they use for Elul and Tishrei. It's not about sin and guilt and hell. And I can say, yes, this is the language that they're using. And I think that what they're offering here as a notion is a very, very relevant one for our time, which is that these months are about noticing that we tend to become alienated from ourselves and that we become alienated from God. It's just life. It's just the busyness of it all. You know, it's just so many things to do and so many responsibilities. But because of that, they speak in this wonderful way about the month of Tishrei, that they speak about the jewel. There is a gem. A beautiful gem, which is our heart, and which is also the Shekhinah, the presence of God in the world. And all of the work of the month of Tishrei is paying attention to the fact that this gem, throughout the year, gets covered with the, how do you call it, like in the kettles, the sediment, the... You know what I'm talking about? Well, that sediment or that covering, that happens because of life, okay? The work of Elul and Tishrei is to polish the gem of our hearts. It's a beautiful notion. Because you think, isn't that interesting? Waking up is the prerequisite for being able to look at what parts have gotten to be not shining. They're not shining. I'm not in connection with them. Because they're not shining. Because they're full of this stuff. And they're full of this schleck. You know, I have to get off. So it's realizing what is covering our heart. And it is doing the work of polishing the doors of our consciousness or the doors of our heart in order to align ourselves or to let the light shine and let the colors of what we could be be present. So that's one thing, that's a totally new idea that they offered in. They call it the Evan Atova, the precious stone. Okay? And these months are about that precious stone. Another thing that is maybe the greatest novelty of the Jewish mystics, and I think why I fell in love with them, is that they understand God not as, you know, one guy with a beard sitting on a throne of judgment. That's totally insufficient for them. They're not living in that world. And they came up with something that really changed Judaism, which is they said, no, that is true, but that is only one aspect of divinity. That is one facet. It's one way in which we meet God. We meet God as order, as law, as judge, as king. But then they said, no, but there's other ways that we experience God. We experience God as mother. We experience God as love. We experience God as source of all, as oneness. Yeah, we experience God in beauty. We experience God in suffering. So what's going to happen to all that? Like, what happens to all those aspects if we don't find a religious language that will have place to them? Then we'll say, oh, if Judaism is this guy with a beard, then I'm out of here, you know? I don't want to say, it doesn't talk to me. I don't listen to that music. But when they suddenly came with these new ideas and said, no, divinity is these infinite spaces or these infinite aspects of God that we wish to be more and more in contact with, suddenly it was a very expanded language, like more people like me, for example, could find their way in. Because so I wanted to say that what they added from this language was that they took the main concept of Elul and Tishrei, which is tshuva, right? Tshuva. And tshuva means, depending on who you are, it means repentance, right? You repent. You say, I did terrible things, ashamti, I did this and I did that, and everything I did was wrong, and I am now, I wish to repent, I wish to go back, I wish to become a good person. That's one way of translating teshuva. Okay? That I want to leave my bad way, and I want to choose, you know, I lost my way in the middle of our life, I went off on the wrong track, I want to return like Virgil or like... What the Zohar added, and I think it's beautiful, they said tshuva is an aspect of God. And tshuva is the great mother. It is the source of life. Okay? And what we are invited to do in the month of Elul and Tishrei is to return. Okay? It's not about repent. It's not about repent this way. But they read the word tshuva as turning around, lashuv, okay, to turn and be present again to where we come from, to the source, to mother, to love, yeah, to the love from which we have come. Okay, now when they present these ideas, they do not present them as polemic. They say, no, this is what tshuva is. Tshuva is, and I want you to just listen to their language. I want to have you look at page number one. Look, can you see the second or the third paragraph? It says, before creating the world, do you see that? Before creating the world, the Blessed Holy One created Tshuva. And he said to Teshuva, okay, this is the personified presence of Teshuva, I want to create a human being in the world on condition that when they return to you, when they return to Teshuva, when they come back to you from their sins, you will be prepared to forgive their sins and grant them atonement. So at every moment, Teshuva is available. people. And when they repent of their sins, this tshuva returns to the Blessed Holy Ones and makes atonement for all. Judgments are subdued and assuaged, and a person is purified of his sin. And when is he purified? When he enters this teshuva, when he comes into a relationship with this aspect called teshuva. And then it says, how do you do it? You have to do it by praying from the depths. Okay? Now look at the last part, the last paragraph. If our prayer should be from the depths, it says here. Now the Abba says, from the depths, there is a hidden place above. It is the depth of the well, from which streams and springs issue in every direction. That deepest depth is called tshuva. And one who wishes to be purified of his sins must call to the Blessed Holy One through this, as it is written, from the depths I call you, Yudhivavi. So this is, first of all, to give you a taste of the language, but what I wanted to offer here as their offering.
For those who want the Hebrew, it's on the.
Yeah, the Hebrew is on the. It's the first paragraph on page 5. I mean, the Zohar is in Aramaic. It's not in Hebrew, but I translated it into Hebrew from Aramaic. And this is the idea, that in order to recreate intimacy with God, we have to find a way to return to a source, to return not to God of law in this case, but to her, to this tshuva. We have to go, or it doesn't have to be her, it can be also something that's just oneness, but we have to call forth our connection to the source and recreate it. Like if you were a Jungian psychologist, you'd say, oh, you know, they're talking about ego self-access. Yes, that's what they're talking about, if you adopt it in their language. But in the mystic language, it's really about realigning, it's recreating our connection to all the levels of who we might be. And I want to end with the last concept, which is the second paragraph, and the third paragraph about confession. You know this confession, vidui, is a big deal in Yom Kippur. Yeah? In Yom Kippur, we make confession. One type of confession is a public confession. It's never in the personal. It's not, I want to say that I did, you know, this wrong this year. I was very angry with my children. I was too angry. Or I didn't treat my mother-in-law well. Or I have a sick friend and I couldn't be with her as much as I wanted to. Or I took very bad care of my soul this year. Or, I mean, there's a lot that we have to look into. Like, how can we be awake to which parts are in the darkness and which parts of us are in the light? I'm saying this also because yesterday I was at the Rijks Museum and I'm like flooded with Rembrandt. I can't really think about the soul now because I'm like, and I'm thinking about how does a great artist create my attention, you know, pay attention to the light. Pay attention to what is illuminated. Everything else just disappears, right? Everything else disappears in the background in those paintings. And you think, pay, you know, simu leve lanshama, pay attention to the soul, like way up. So confession is very interesting. When we in the synagogue make confession, it is the general confession. Ashamnu, bagadnu, it's general. Some of it is in order not to shame people. You know, people will get up and say. On the other hand, in the Orthodox liturgy, we've lost the personal connection to confession. Because all we say, we repeat these ancient words, we say, al chetche chatano, because of a sin that we did on this, and al chetche chatano on this, and this. So the Zohar comes here and adds a new wonderful dimension, and it says, you know, vidui is very important because you cannot enter the gates of Yom Kippur without vidui. Because if you want to return, you can't return if you don't know where you are. You have to first say, this is where I'm standing, you know, pretty bad or pretty good, or to do something that allows us to go through a question of where are we in order to wake up. So what they added, which I think is beautiful, is they said, you don't have to imagine confession only as confessing before a judge. Don't think of it that way only. I think it's very redemptive saying, no, confession isn't bad. Confession to God is a confession that you have to ask yourself, like, which types of confession do I want to make? And the Zohar goes on to differentiate, and it says, no, remember, first you have to confess as if you were confessing to Mother Earth or to your mother or to a beloved, caring person. And that would be a totally different way of saying, like, where am I? If you would compare it to what you would say if you're standing in front of a judge. Yeah, if somebody is holding you. And you can say what is heavy on your heart, like where you're standing, that would be. And then the Zohar says, and then if you think of atonement and you think of confession, you have to confess as if you're standing before your drive and your passion. And you have to have a conversation with your passion. And say, yes, I know, this is what I'm doing, or this is what I did because of my passions. You have to be in contact with them. And then the Zohar says, and then you also have to imagine that you're standing in front of the king or the judge. You have to walk in there, and you have to, in sacred, your sacred imagination, say, yes, you know, from the point of view of law, I transgressed here and here and here, and confess the confession that suits the courtroom. And then the Zohar adds the last thing, and it says, after you've done all that, you can't stay in guilt. You can't stay there. If you want to continue living, Shuvah is not about guilt. Then you have to take everything that you've confessed, and you have to give it as an offering to God as source, just compassion. You give it to the great ocean. You know, in Tashlich, in Rosh Hashanah, the tradition is that we actually act it out. We take out of our pockets, we take our sins, and we throw them into a lake or to a canal. Very easy in Amsterdam, very difficult in Jerusalem. Go find a source of living, running water that you can say here. Now, there's something very beautiful about that ritual. Because it means I want to continue living. I'm throwing out my, excess luggage. I want to start the new year in a lighter way. So in Israel, they say this beautiful thing is that when you've done your work of awakening and of confession, you then have to take this and give it as an offering to God as the great ocean of compassion. Trusting that that ocean can carry anything. It can carry. It can tolerate. It can take you in whatever way you are, in whatever darkness that you have to offer. So you offer it, and only then you can start your experience of Shiva, feeling that you have worked through the alienation in order to come to a relationship of more intimacy. And these are ideas, I just want to end with this. These are wonderful, wonderful ideas. And they totally opened the hearts of Jews that were reading them. And therefore, the Zohar became the most sacred book after the Tanakh and after the oral tradition. Right? By the 16th century, this is the third holiest book in our tradition. But I think, you know, that rating, I'm not really interested in that. What I'm interested in is that they found a way that religion would be relevant for the life of people at the time that they're writing it. I mean, just as we have to find, like, what are the parts of light that we can bring into our religious practice that we can work with and that are alive in 2011. In the same way, they were really trying to do it, and they did a wonderful job of saying, let's pour this new wine in our new understanding of vidui, yeah, of confession, in our new understanding of intimacy with God, and in our new understanding of tshuva. So I hope it gives you good provision for the way for these coming months. Thank you.
Thank you. No, stay there. Stay there. Thank you. The question was whether we make a break or we take your questions straight away before you forget them. And then we'll have a nice drink or something in a little while. But there was not much conversation, so we should have a little conversation.
Oh, happily.
Yes? Anyone wants to start? Protests. Objections. No? Where can you
read? Are we awake? Are we awake?
Wake up. That's all?
Yeah.
Really want coffee that much?
When do we know whether we are awake? Whether we are awake from our sleep?
Okay, once again.
Yeah.
How do we know when we try to awaken? How do we know we are awakened?
Well, by the way, that's part of their discussion of, you know, why wake up? Maybe it's better to be asleep, because then how do we know, like, are we living up to our fullest capacity? But they will say, you will know, because your heart will know, and because the way you will be affecting the world around you, yeah, the way you will be bringing blessing to the world around you, you will notice that that's what you're doing. Like, maybe I'll just say something about it. They say when you are awake, you can notice in a more enhanced way what is blocking the dynamic of abundance or blessing or goodness in the world. If you are asleep, you're not aware of that. But if you are awake, and that's where the question of responsibility comes in, when you are awake, you know. And when you know, you have to act. And when you have to act, you have to understand, oh, you know, all this canal is plugged with garbage. And I have to clean it out in order for this flow to come here. So, from that point of view, they will not say, you know, there's a beautiful poem of Rumi, who's also 13th century in another part of the world, but in the same kind of intuition where he says, friend, stay up with us. We are made of the material that is trying to stay awake. And I think in saying trying to stay awake, there's an understanding. We can't be awake all the time. If we'd be awake all the time, like you said, we would be crazy. But we know that we suddenly experience the world in a way that is different than we were experiencing it when we were dulled, drugged, asleep, not in our highest spirit. I think we all know that. And I just want to add, because it makes me remember something very lovely, is that when they speak about what is the experience of being awake can be all kinds of things. Like, when do we experience ourselves as very awake? I mean, what would you say? When do we know in our life that we had moments that we said, I'm very awake now? I mean, danger, yes. Yes, other one?
When you gave birth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. At many levels. Yeah.
When my wife gave birth.
A total awakeness. Yeah. Any other ones? What? When we're in love? When we're in deep, deep love? And when... Absolutely, yeah. You can you see all your life going in front of you, and you see what life is or what your life was. So yes.
When the physical alignment is connected.
Absolutely, beautiful. Yeah. When you feel like you're breathing in all of you, yes.
I think just moments when you truly, truly, truly follow your heart, there's a kind of the fragility, I'm going to say, liberation, and for a moment, you're in the
presence. Beautiful. You see, even if you can notice that there's a lot of ways of being awake. And it's very interesting that when the mystics speak about it as well, they really speak of a soft awakening. You know, they're aware that there's the adrenaline awakeness, which is very powerful. You know, we can move the world in adrenaline awakening. But they're saying, no. The wakefulness that we need in order to wake consciousness is actually to lower the threshold of our very common sense, normative view of what we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to look, and lower that. And when you lower that, you can suddenly wake up. You can, not suddenly actually, you can slowly wake up. And it's a much more nocturnal and poetic and spiritual. And many times in their sense, it's very erotic also. It's very symbolic and it's a tingling kind of waking up. You know, oh, it was dormant all this time, and it's now waking up. So that's part of answers. Yes?
Zohar is quite often symmetric in the sense that it goes on here, goes on that. Okay. Can you say that the Zohar also is speaking about the sleep of God sleeping? God need to be waking up or else?
Excellent. Yes?
God,
the answer is yes.
Should God confess to us?
The answer is yes, and by the way, yeah, they do have a very developmental theology from the point of view that because it's religion is actually an experience of this mutual relationship, that when we shine, divinity shines. When divinity shines, we can shine back. That there, it's about clearing that gem above and below. There's no question that they say yes, and there are aspects of God that our experience is that they're fast asleep. And by the way, they don't have to invent this Jewishly because you have these powerful sentences in Torah. You know, Kuma Lama Tishan Adonai, wake up God. What are you doing asleep? Which is the absolute mirror image of Ben Adam, Malek HaNirdam, you know, man, wake up, human being. Say, Ua Lama Tishan Adonai, wake up God, why are you asleep? Okay? But that's an aspect of God that you can say is asleep, and that's why the Zohar says, maybe that aspect of God the judge is sometimes present and sometimes not present. And that's why we call that presence asleep or awake. But higher, higher above that aspect is divinity as total compassion. It's not intervening in the world. It's not about, you know, it's not a political divinity. It is total love. It is total compassion. And about that aspect, they say, it says, Hine lo yanum velo yanum. That aspect is never asleep. Yeah. Wait, I don't hear.
There is a state between sleeping and waking, which is dreaming. Is there any place in this whole setup where you think or know that dreaming is wrong?
Well, that's a beautiful question. They spend a lot of time on dreaming because dreaming, in their understanding, and actually it's the traditional Jewish understanding that stems from Tanakh and through tractate Brachot in Gemara that deals really with dream and dream interpretation. But for the Zohar, it's dreams are the time of night that our soul gets intimations about herself and about the world and about God. And that's why dreams are a 60th part of prophecy. And they don't read that as meaning, oh, it's not important. You know, you could say, if dreaming is one of 60th, in prophecy, you could say, Echad b'shishim is batel b'shishim. It's nothing. It's negligible. You say, no, it's 1/60th of a prophecy, which means it is a state of revelation. If we are not in a clear connection with Shekhinah, or with the feminine aspect of God, or with God in our daily life, at night we are. And that's what happens through dreams. And also, by the way, they have very, very ornate discussions about the travels of the soul at night when we dream. We can do that for another whole seminar on dreams. Yeah. Yeah.
Sleep restores the body and the brain. Does the Zohar have any positive function for this sleeping of the consciousness? Does it speak about any sort of function of this not being awake?
It's a good question altogether about sleep. I would say it depends if we're speaking metaphorically about sleep or if we're speaking physically about sleep. When we speak metaphorically, they will speak about sleep is a sleep of consciousness and not sleep is regeneration. But when they speak about the night sleep, and you know, their tradition was that they would go to sleep at dusk when the sun would go down. You know, remember, this is also a world with no electricity, and also the first part of the night was regarded as a very dangerous, dark part of the night. So they would go to sleep at dusk, and they would wake up at midnight, and they would be awake till after dawn. This was their tradition. And they say it's very important to sleep. First of all, sleep allows, they say every night, this is a Zohar I'm just now working on. So they say every night when we fall asleep, all of the powers of our life come into our heart like the animals into Noah's Ark. It's beautiful. Really beautiful reading. And we are starting to fall asleep, and all the vital parts of what is our vitality all come into the ark, which is the heart. And we close our eyes, and we are all collected in that ark. And then when we sleep, the waters of the flood, you know, these waters of the subconscious, they start rising in the body, yeah? But the heart floats like an ark. And then the window of the ark is opened, and the dove, the yonah, that we started speaking as if, she flies out in order to go for her nocturnal travels, you know, to see God, to receive intimation. So sleep is very important because it's also surrender. You know, we say the prayer at night, be'adcha afkid ruchi. We surrender our soul to you, and we allow ourselves to go into sleep. So that sleep will be seen as something very positive. I think the place where the call is a rebuking call is, why do we choose to spend our life being sleepwalkers? They're saying, why? It could be very different if we were awake. We could do so much more if we weren't dulled. So I think that's how they position it. Yeah. I think they read it all in like levels of alienation. Like when we're not aware, that is the dynamic. The dynamic is still waters. We're not in movement. Something is not alive. And we lose touch to it because it is in our nature that we forget, that we do not pay attention. It is part of creation, and it's because creation is in the law of time, that things are born and they come to full fruition and then they become old and then they slowly die and then they are reborn and again you have that cycle. within that cycle, you have, you know, sleep and wakefulness and falling asleep. It's part of the deal. But there is a very strong sense that there's something that is lazy about it, that we could be different. It's not, oh, isn't this terrible that this is the way we are? No, they're saying, no, it could be different if we would wake up.
There's no difference between Dandema and Shena.
Well, it depends where, but I just have to remind us that we're talking about something that is not unique to Judaism. Right? What is the meaning of the word Buddha? Buddha is the awakened one. What is Buddhism? Yeah, awaken. I mean, this intuition that we're asleep it's not the invention of Judaism. It's a strong human intuition that you can find in Alexandria of the 2nd century BC and in all the Gnostic groups in the Matrix movie, in Christian mysticism, that I was blind and now I was lost and I am found, or I was blind, is a sense that we tend to lose connection to who we are or to who we could be.
Doesn't the Zohar say anything about the process of awakening? I can, because it seems to be, being asleep seems to be the opposite of being awake. So what happens to make the transition, or is it a whole process?
Well, it's a whole process. First of all, I'll just say that they have techniques. And their techniques are very simple. When you're sitting with friends at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the world is very quiet, and you don't have to go over your accounts in the stock market, and you don't have to bring the kids back from school, and the world is very quiet, and the light is not the light of the sun, but the light of the moon and the stars, you can surprise yourself. You're tired. That is their awakening. You suddenly find that what they do generally is they start with a verse of Torah and they start playing with it like jazz players. They are great artists and they start riffing. But this riffing, right? You take a verse and you start thinking of it, but you don't say, what did Rashi think about this? No. What do I feel about this? They start going with it. They will pick up on what maybe the earlier people said about it and say, oh, that was so beautiful, but now I want to go and I want to say what I... So it's a process. It's a process. Waking to everything is a process. Waking... You know, when William Blake wrote, to see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower, that doesn't happen only like conversion of the heart in one moment. It happens many times after we've been sick and after we've been through crisis and after we've been through it's amazing. I never noticed the world around me this way. Generally, it tends to be a process, and they will treat it that way. And I think, you know, I was reading Evelyn Underhill, who was this wonderful woman in England who wrote a book in 1911. She was the first woman to write this book about mysticism. Very educated, very. And when she writes about this waking up, she says, you know, sometimes, like William James writes, we have moments of abrupt awakening. You know, from one minute to the other, I've been transformed. Like St. Paul. Boom! You know, suddenly I cannot be the same person. But she says there very beautifully, sometimes it's a process. Sometimes we can hardly notice that we're moving in a direction. Many times it can be in the second part of our life. And not in the first. That we are noticing that we are awakening to things that we were asleep to. And so that's how they see it. And that's why, by the way, it's not something that you wake up and that's the end. No. It's always going to be that cycle of being aware of that. Yes?
In the country of Erasmus, we looked in praise of folly, and we questioned the role of the wise person in the world of folly. So let's make a jump with the imagination. What if we had our group of awake people in the same environment, with everybody half asleep and a little foolish? And what is the role of the
wise
person in the world of folly?
Well, maybe it's true that the world of folly would be translated here as the world of those who are kind of drowsy or dopey or sleepy.
Numb
or traumatized or in total pain. Yes, I mean, there has to be a lot of compassion around these questions. But really, there's no question that in the Zohar, they see their group, the inner group, is the group that is trying to stay awake. We're trying to stay awake. We're going to fall asleep, but we're trying to stay awake. What they will offer is to say, you have to wake other people up. You have to tap them on the shoulder. You have to slap them once in a while. You have to, if you're Rabbi Nachman, which I think is even more beautiful, if they're very, very fast asleep, you have to tell them stories. You will not wake them up by telling them that God is going to be angry with them. You're not going to wake them up by telling them that they're not abiding by the law. You're not going to be able to wake them up by telling them the stories of the Bible. You have to go back to the archetypal. You have to tell them stories and slowly bring them into a position where they can see their face and feel that they are awake. Yeah, and that's the way, by the way, that Rabbi Nachman, it's 19th century, 1906, he writes and says, most people are asleep most of the time. You know, it's his sense as well. Most people are asleep most of the time. So tell them stories. Wake them up gently.
Do you think that in history there are periods that it's a sick, cyclical thing that we have periods during the ages which are more enlightened than other periods?
You mean historically?
Yes, we see this in Judaism. We see this, for instance, in Dutch history.
Yep.
The Golden Age was not only about economics, it was.
Absolutely. I don't know what they would say about it. I can say that there's no question that when you study comparative religions, you're very struck by the fact that certain times are just amazing from the point of view of change, you know, suddenly expansion of the horizon of human creativity, or as I tend to say, being a 13th century person myself, you know, I wonder what they put in the water. You know, how can you explain that you have Dogen, Rumi, Zohar all happening in the same time, like the axial age? It's a fascinating question. I don't think I can answer it. I'm not a Hegelian and I don't have the keys. But it is fascinating to see how change takes place in certain times, like in all these places where suddenly the light comes up, and then how other times are times where you suddenly see the sun go down. The sun is setting on humanity and everything goes dark in different places. And by the way, maybe we'll end with this, but Cycling, who was my favorite Zohar lover in the world, who Hilit Cycling, who was a wonderful journalist and writer and mystic and poet and scholar of Zohar, who died in a Warsaw ghetto, and who was the first to start the project of translating. So when he starts his big chapter, citing about the Zohar, he says, when the sun of the great golden age was not at its height anymore, and the dark night, you know, of Inquisition was starting to make its way. And he sees it, you know, in this kind of cyclical time, that certain times allow a lot of light in, and others close upon us. So that's how he opens his big chapter on the bell. Thank you. Yes?
Yeah? Last one.
I think that, yes.
I just wanted to still make a comment from Tamara about why. And I think that it's because of pain.
Yes.
I think that we shut down because of pain. And we see it with, I mean, sometimes I feel on the street, I feel a child crying, and parents walking, dragging it along, or child crying on bicycles, and they just keep on bicycling.
I absolutely feel with you the same intuition, and I can say it in a very painful way about the Middle East, you know, about my beloved country that I come from, in Israel. That when I look at both Israelis and Palestinians that I spend a lot of time working with, you can see that fear creates a shutting off of ourselves from ourselves, and it creates a hardening of the heart. And the hardening of the heart is that is already alienation. And it's just, and it's fear, and it's fear of pain also. But, you know, I'm seeing it. I'm seeing, like, this new wave of violence erupting in the Middle East. You see that one of the first reactions is a shutdown of many systems. And it's true. Life is too painful. You know, we are so small. So I think that's the beautiful part, actually, of Elul and Tishrei. It's not just rebuking it, it's saying we have to have some time in the year where we pay attention.
You bring us into the present. I know you're in batch involved in Palestinian Israeli reconciliation work. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I think it's very important now for waking up.
I can tell you it's important for me. What's most important for me to say is that about this is that I think that since the beginning of the First Intifada, we have a big problem in Israel that we don't get to be with Palestinian youth or adults face to face. We just don't. If you're a soldier, you have to meet Palestinians in the check posts. My son is in the army. You know, all the kids in the army can tell you it's no fun. You are the powerful soldier, and you are also very afraid. And you're looking at the other as the other, and as the potential enemy, as your potential killer, and he's looking at you as the potential killer and the potential power. And children don't get to see Israeli children because we're more and more segregated. And the Sulcha Peace Project that I'm very involved in since 2000 has decided, you know, that it's very important not to wait for the efforts that are happening on the legislative front and the political and the diplomatic front. We can't wait because there always has to be wakefulness for the fact that we have to create safe conditions where just Israelis and Palestinians can meet as human beings. Because I would say that the most dangerous thing, and Europe knows a lot about this, but we know a lot about it in our part of the world. If you don't see the other as a human being, you can kill them. It's that simple. Yeah, or as somebody said beautifully, An enemy is somebody whose story you haven't heard yet. Now, I'm not naive. I'm not saying, oh, there's no enemies and we're all one and we're all... No. I'm saying that we have to make an effort to maintain the person-to-person level of allowing me to sit with Palestinian women of my age, of youth, to sit with youth, of people, to sit with different kinds of people from the other side, and make music together, and cook food together, and cry together, and pray together, and bring the spiritual into piecework. Because most piecework in Israel and Palestine is very secular. I mean, secular meaning, let's take out the stories of our tradition. It's too dangerous. It's too inflammable. It's going to blow everything up. Let's talk democracy, rights. But our feeling in the Sulpah Peace Project is that you have to bring in our sacred stories. You can't just throw them out with the bathwater and say, we're not going to use it. No, you have to use the stories. You have to use the fact that we're all the children of Abraham. You have to find a way to use faith, the shared faith, the desire of people, and bring them into reconciliation process. So there's a lot of work to do, and in the Middle East, doing this kind of peace work is like working in the fog. But that's where God is.